Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Gwyneth Doland. Today, one of every 100 Americans is behind bars. Since 1980, the prison population has quadrupled. This hard-on-drugs sentencing law situation was put into place by Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton. I'm breathing hard this morning because I just ran in here. All of this with bipartisan support from Congress. And these laws have put people who sold small amounts of drugs in prison for 50 years, even life. Now, three-quarters of federal drug offenders given mandatory minimum sentences are Black or Hispanic. In New Mexico, we spend about $300 million a year to house more than 6,000 offenders and supervise another 1,800. Half of the people we release from New Mexico prisons will be back behind bars within 5 years. And it costs us nearly $35,000 a year to keep each person here. President Obama recently announced a major push for an overhaul of the criminal justice system, saying we need to stop keeping nonviolent offenders in prison for so long. Many Republicans agree that keeping these mandatory minimum sentences is unfair and expensive, but how can we break this cycle? My guests today are Captain Jerome Sanchez of the Santa Fe Police Department and State Senator John Ryan. Welcome, Senator Ryan, here in the studio with me. And do we have Captain Sanchez on the phone?
I am here. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. We also want to hear from you callers, so do call us now, 277-5866, or toll-free, 877-899-5866. Senator Ryan, I want to start with you. I mentioned in the intro here that we spend about $35,000 a year keeping people in prison. Do you know how much we spend on public school kids, each one, every year?
Well, I think that's a good thing to explore.
It's about $7,000.
Oh, well, there you go.
So it costs us five times as much to keep someone behind bars as it does to keep them in school, which probably felt at some times like being behind bars, but it's not. How much of a challenge does this present to you? You know, part of your job in the legislature is to make a budget. So how challenging is it for you to figure out how to come up with the money to keep so many people in prison? I mean, $300 million is a lot of money.
I think it's not only the amount of cost that that we spend and taxpayer dollars go towards housing people in prison, but it's also building prisons. I think the overcrowded aspects of our prison are requiring that the state and taxpayers pay additional monies to build prisons, and then it's getting more and more expensive. It's not coming down, so that $35,000 is probably going up because we're wanting to do more and more programs for the people in prison to help them, you know, cope with life kinds of things. So that when they get out, they're much more adaptable to re-entering into society.
Captain, you know, I posted about this show on my Facebook page before we started today, and I mentioned that there's this program in Santa Fe that sends some drug addicts who have been caught stealing stuff into treatment rather than arresting them and sending them to jail. And someone posted this comment that I wanted you to hear. It says, as a victim of countless property thefts in New Mexico, it already seems like the lack of consequences is enough reward to keep offenders repeating the crime. We are slapping them on the hand even after multiple offenses. And she said, this seems like a word that means hooey. So let me ask you this, Captain. Why did the city decide to take people who had been committing these crimes and put them into treatment instead of jail?
Well, I think we have to kind of, as a society, really take a look at why people are doing what they're doing and kind of combat the issue at hand, which is addiction, and treating it as a medical issue as opposed to a criminal issue, and to try to stop that cycle. Some of our offenders are generations deep, and so in a proactive approach to trying to solve these things, we're looking at the root cause, which is ultimately addiction.
And so you started this program about a year and a half ago. How does it work?
It is a law enforcement assisted diversion. So really the way it's designed is that law enforcement officers on the street encounter people who have maybe committed low-level crimes, or they are in possession of low-level amounts of narcotics or paraphernalia. They then make a determination based on a strict set of criteria whether or not an individual can be diverted into treatment, directly into treatment and wraparound services, as opposed to going through the traditional criminal justice system.
And these are people that you've picked up sometimes dozens of times before for the exact same crimes. Is that right?
Correct. And we debrief these people and talk to them and ask them what we can do to help them and stop the cycle that we're seeing. So overwhelmingly, all these people are saying, we need to go to treatment, we need treatment, we need treatment. So it didn't seem like a very hard thing to figure out, and said, well, we need to start looking at treatment options.
Captain, I think any of our listeners who've ever dealt with addiction issues in their family knows that it is really hard to find treatment programs and that they are extremely expensive. So I'm sure many of them are thinking, Santa Fe is paying to, you know, put these folks in rehab. Isn't that more expensive than keeping them in jail?
Well, treatment is, as we all maybe have these preconceived notions that maybe treatment is quote-unquote rehab. Rehab is many different things. So really it's about intensive case management individually with these people and their immediate needs. So traditional forms of rehab, quote-unquote rehab, take many, many facets of treatment. So it could be simple as going to 12-step meetings, and that may be sufficient for some people to stop using. And then it could be full intensive inpatient treatment for some other individual. So to clump everybody into a rehab, a traditional rehab setting, is probably not efficient and not effective.
But so your program is helping people get off drugs, you say?
Our ultimate goal is we are a program that really prescribes to a notion of harm reduction. So I'm not going to stamp out addiction completely, and this is not a magic bullet, so to speak. And what we're trying to do is reduce the harmful effects of addiction. So if we can reduce the use, and if we can reduce all the other consequences that happen with addiction, then I think we're in great shape.
So I think my Facebook friend wants to know, is your program having an impact on the number of people who are getting their stuff stolen?
Yeah, and so ultimately we have to look at, as law enforcement personnel, we have to look at whether or not the program works. We look at recidivism rates. Our model is programmed directly after Seattle's model. Seattle just released their evaluation piece, and it looks like 56% of individuals are less likely to recidivate compared to traditional law enforcement, or I'm sorry, criminal justice measures. So anecdotally, we're seeing a huge drop in recidivism rates with our clients who are involved in our program.
In Seattle, they just completed a part of their review. I know you told me earlier that you have not had a program evaluation yet, but in Seattle, they showed that recidivism rates are down by as much as 60%. So people are getting rearrested less. Senator Ryan, I want to come back to you briefly, because I think what we've just described, you know, feels to a lot of liberals like a great idea, real touchy-feely. Let's help these people. Let's get at the root of the problem. They don't need to be in jail. Jail is bad. But I think my Facebook commenter points out that people are angry about the effects that drugs have on our communities, and they want these people to be punished. I think it's interesting that there has come to be this bipartisan support for changing the way we handle drug crimes now. Can you tell me a little bit about how this works politically when it seems kind of hard to figure out the angles here?
Well, I think what you're seeing not only in Washington but in New Mexico and across the country and state legislative bodies, you are seeing a bipartisan effort come together with regard to these mandatory minimum sentences on nonviolent kinds of issues and crimes and drugs and I think it's because you've got a number of conservatives that are very worried about how much money is going to incarcerate individuals, how much are we going to be spending on prisons, so the prison population, prison overcrowding.
It has a big financial cost, and this is something, I guess, that appeals to fiscal conservatives.
Yeah, and I think the legalization of marijuana in our neighboring state of Colorado and Washington, I think you're seeing an acceptance that there's a lot of use for our younger kids, a lot of more opportunities that they're getting exposed to these kinds of things at a younger age, and that's going to continue. So what is the answer? Is it to lock up more people? Is it to keep people off the street by still continuing to apply the tough minimum mandatory sentences? Or is there another way? Is there a way we can grab these kids early, try and get them into a different direction to where they may be exposed to these kinds of things, drugs and alcohol, at an earlier age? But is there something we can do to show them that there's another way? There's things that they can do to correct their course, get on the right path. And I think all those kinds of programs are filtering into the corrections system itself. But if we don't find another route, we're going to continually be faced with building more prisons and incarcerating more people. And I think both sides, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals, agree that that's not the right course. It hasn't worked to this point.
You bring up a great point, which there's so many problems here, and it is so complicated, and there are a million ideas of how to make it work. Listeners, we want to hear your ideas. So call us today, right now, at 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. Call us toll-free at 877-899-5866. We're also looking for you on social media, so you can look at our Facebook page, KUNM Radio. I'm looking at these comments now. You can tweet to us at KUNM News, and you can email us, callinshow@kunm.org. We will be right back in 1 minute.
Edible Arrangements at 4770 Montgomery Boulevard Northeast in Albuquerque offers fresh fruit bouquets and chocolate-dipped fruit for any occasion. EdibleArrangements.com or 505-888-0100. Edible Arrangements is a valued supporter of KUNM. The UNM Urogynecology Division is looking for women who suffer from accidental bowel leakage who are interested in participating in a research study. This study will compare treatment plans that include medications, physical therapy, and usual care. Contact Urogyne Research for more details, 505-967-8428. That's 505-967-8428. A message from the tax-exempt University of New Mexico.
Support comes from New Mexico Jazz Workshop, presenting Ladies and Gents Singing and Swinging in the Club this Saturday, August 1st, Albuquerque Museum, with Entourage Jazz and special guests. Tickets at the door, open 6:30, or holdmyticket.com.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland, and we are talking this morning about the cost, the moral and the financial cost, of keeping so many people in this country and in this state behind bars for so long. In the studio with me is State Senator John Ryan, Republican from Albuquerque. He serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And on the phone is Captain Sanchez of the Santa Fe Police Department, who works with a law enforcement assisted diversion program in Santa Fe that's taking an unusual approach to eliminating or reducing, I know the captain would like me to say, reducing property crime and reducing the other effects to the community of addiction. Welcome back to the program. I want to go to the phones and take a call from Sermin in Albuquerque, who runs a jail diversion program. Sermin, what is your program like?
Hello. We are with the Veterans Integration Centers, and we provide a jail diversion for veterans who are at risk of becoming homeless. So we try to catch them before they get back on the streets and start running with the same crowd as before and end up back into incarceration. We've been operating the program for at least a year, and we've been able to get about 8 veterans from the prisons across the state. 63% of them have found housing through and income or through employment or benefits. 2 of them are currently in-house and still working on programs. And we work directly with the VA for those that are having SUD issues, substance use issues.
Sermin, let me interrupt you for 1 second and go back to Captain Sanchez in Santa Fe, because you mentioned that your program helps a few dozen people. Captain Sanchez, I know we only have a couple more minutes with you. How many people are in the LEAD program in Santa Fe right now?
We have roughly 38.
And what has, you know, what is the impact most succinctly been on those people and the impact in the community, would you say?
Well, I think ultimately we have to look at whether, again, it quote-unquote works. I think, again, anecdotally, I can tell you that, yes, out of these 38 clients, that some have been in the program since the implementation, which is about a year and 3-4 months ago, none of them have committed any, burglaries or major property crimes. We have had some recidivism as far as some people getting arrested for silly things that they didn't take care of, like, tickets that they didn't pay, fines, stuff like that, and some minor shoplifting stuff.
But on a small scale, you say your program is working to keep and these are mostly heroin addicts, am I right?
Correct. Our program is mainly or really just an opiate program.
So. Right. So prescription opiates as well as heroin. Thank
Correct.
You, Captain Sanchez. I know we have to let you get to a meeting in the department this morning. Thank you so much for being with us for at least a little while.
Thank you all.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So, Sermin, what have been the biggest impacts of your program on keeping veterans out of the criminal justice system?
We work hand-in-hand with the VA to address any SUD issues that they're having. What we do in the program is we meet every veteran wherever they are at and provide a plan. We put a plan together, individual service plan, with their goals, and we try to set them up with the service providers in the community to make sure that we're arriving at those goals and making sure that they're not hanging out with the same individuals who they were hanging out with prior to getting incarcerated and leading to their incarceration.
Sermin, thank you so much for telling us about that program. Senator Ryan, hearing a little bit about how these programs work, how feasible, I mean, assuming that, well, let's say hypothetically, the Santa Fe program returns results that look like Seattle's, which the community there said was very promising, was working. How feasible do you think it would be to implement something like this on a broader scale in the state? What do you think the debate would sound like in the legislature?
Well, we've already had the debate to some degree. Santa Fe came in and asked the legislature for, I don't know what the exact approval was, but we were briefed on this program when they were implementing it. And we did have some say as to how it would work, and so I think everybody's watching. We're watching to see what the results will be.
Santa Fe's pretty progressive. I mean, how do you think this would play out in Hobbs or Clovis or Pitalis?
I don't think it's for everybody, and that probably ought to be the start. but it ought to be for those that are committed to doing it right. And I think there's different programs that can be managed and run in a way that just puts more discretion. In Santa Fe's case, it's discretion from the officer. The officer is making the decision as to whether or not this person that they've just arrested or taken into their possession, that they divert them either to a jail or through the criminal justice system, or do they go a different route, and a route that's supposedly to help them with their addiction and their issues. That discretion, I think, is really important, whether it's discretion of the officer or discretion of the judge. Some of the laws that we have on the books currently doesn't give anybody any discretion. So if there's somebody arrested for a specific a crime, you know, there's a mandatory minimum, and those are the kinds of things that we think can change and ought to change, frankly.
I think there's a big difference, too, in this debate between problems we have in Santa Fe with heroin and opiate addiction and problems that we see in other areas with things like marijuana. And this sentencing can really start to seem out of proportion to the crime. You know, we have a lot of people in prison now who were sentenced under mandatory minimum laws who are doing far more time for having small amounts of drugs than people who have been convicted of rape and even murder and terrorism. You know, John Oliver on HBO just had a segment on this week. Did you see it, Senator?
I did. A really funny guy. And he presents a really meaningful case in a comical kind of way. But he nailed it because he really gets at the point of, you know, is this right? And I think anybody that sees that program or digs into this issue a little deeper will come to the conclusion that there's certain people in jail that shouldn't be there, and we need to do something about it.
We have a caller on the line, Jan, who says that a lot of nonviolent criminals, which is these people we're talking about, as opposed to rapists and murderers, get out of jail all the time and recommit crimes. Jan, what's your experience with this?
Well, it's not mine personally, but several friends in and around the area. There's a guy who he gets arrested, gets thrown in jail. As soon as he gets back out, he steals again, and one friend was ripped off $20,000 worth of tools, and then this guy took a $30,000 vehicle. And these are nonviolent crimes. I don't know what his drug issues are. If you would assume that there are some, that never seems to get raised. He has a recidivism record that has filled a three-ring binder,
Jan,
and he's out again. He's out again. But this is a nonviolent crime. And I guess one of my questions relative to cost is, why isn't the insurance industry weighing in on this? Because, you know, if I get robbed, which I have been, well, you know, homeowner's insurance will cover it, or this will cover it, or your car insurance. Well, that adds up. That adds up a lot of money. And I guess I'm curious as to that cost versus the incarceration cost, and how are nonviolent crimes really being defined?
Thank you so much for that, Jan. Let's talk about that for a minute. I think if we hadn't had to let Captain Sanchez go, we would hear him say that this program in Santa Fe came about because the property crime statistics were so high and because the officers said they were arresting, just like Jan just said, the same people over and over and over again for stealing things like tools and stereos and whatever. And that they decided that what they discovered, that drug abuse was the root of that problem in Santa Fe. So to help them with their drug addiction means that they would not steal anymore. We have one more call here from Ginger in Alcalde. Ginger, you work at a rehab center. And how is it that folks at your rehab center can get out of the criminal justice system?
Hi, thanks for listening. That's a great show. I'm really glad you're doing it. I don't work at a rehab center. I volunteer at Delancey Street Foundation, which is a drug and rehab prison alternative. Many of the people there have to be interviewed by Delancey Street or have to apply and get interviewed to get in, and it's a 2-year program. I've been over there for 3 years. I, And I have to say that the program is the answer to, it is a very complex answer to what your discussion is about. They started in San Francisco. I think most people in New Mexico know about Delancey Street, but they don't know what they do over there. And what I'd like to ask is if anybody, any of your guests have any experience with Delancey Street, and also if for people to feel more free to contact Delancey Street, if they have people in prison that they know who are ready to recover, because Delancey Street's program really, really works. And I don't know if there's any information that you have about that, if you're aware of it, because it's up here in Alcalde. And they have about 100 residents there.
And right this now. Is it's a residential program where folks go if they would otherwise go to prison, they can possibly go to this program and they work. They eventually gain privileges and are able to work in the community. Am I right?
Yeah, they actually stay for 2 years on property and learn how to work. That's the first thing they do. They come in, usually don't have any skills about working, and the first 4 to 6 months, they work 16-hour days. And they learn skills. They learn how to drive trucks. They learn how to fix cars. They learn how to cook. They learn how to work and get skills. And beyond that, they're learning how to do self-control.
Ginger, I know you said you're only a volunteer, but you have been there a little while.
I'm very committed to it. I've been there 3 years, so...
How many people do you see just not making it and dropping out of the program?
You know, from the time I've been there, and I don't have statistics, but from the time I've been there, I would say less than a quarter drop out.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah, it's very, very, it's very successful, but it's hard, and it should be hard. And I know I'm a liberal, but these people do, and I have been robbed more than anybody on my county road. So I still go, because these are human beings. They're not just criminals. These are human beings. And once you see them recover and rehab, you go, they are me. They are just like me. They just made terrible choices. And I have come from some terrible situations. But I just wanted to call in to just talk about Delancey Street, because it is one of the many things that we're doing that is really successful.
Thank you, Ginger. Thank you so much for that. I want to bring in right now Emily Kaltenbach of the Drug Policy Alliance, who's been working on this for a while now. Thank you for being with us, Emily.
Good morning, Gwyneth. Thanks for having me on your show.
You know, we were talking earlier about the political elements here, and, you know, President Obama recently became the first sitting president to tour a federal prison. He commuted the sentences of 40-some prisoners in one day, which is the most that any president has ever done in one day. And he made a real statement about people who were sentenced to extremely long terms in prison for drug crimes that carry shorter sentences now, and that we have come to see don't accomplish, in many cases, the goals we started out with. House Speaker John Boehner just said this week, we've got a lot of people in prison who don't need to be there, and it's expensive. And he said, some of these people are in there for what I'll call flimsy reasons. Now, that might be an exaggeration, but I think, you know, we have all seen these cases in the news of folks who had some small amount of pot 20 years ago and are in there for life in prison. John Oliver had several of these folks on that clip and from his show this past week. Emily, your group tries to advocate for drug laws that you think are more sensible. What do you guys think we need to do to solve the problem we have now of so many people in prison for so long?
Yeah, I mean, I think you mentioned this is a really extraordinary moment for both drug policy and criminal justice reform in the United States. And so our organization is at the forefront for advocating for changes both at a federal and a state level. I think, you know, we've heard in your show already about reducing mandatory minimums and looking at some sentencing reform. I think we also advocate that we need to see some work done on the front end so that we're not creating a pipeline into our jails and prison. So, for example, you know, I think the LEAD program, which you heard, which we've been a major advocate for, is an example of what can happen at a local level. This is pre-booking. It's a step away from the criminal justice system. So nonviolent individuals who've committed a drug crime that maybe possess a small amount for personal use, they're struggling with addiction, that really should be treated as a public health issue and outside of the criminal justice system. So I think LEAD is a great example. I think we really need to trim, you know, the number of nonviolent crimes that we have, both at a federal and a state level. And we've seen, you know, decriminalization of marijuana in many states for many, many years. I mean, it's been over 40 years in some states. And so I think there needs to be a greater look at whether we need to decriminalize small amounts of drugs at a local level and a federal level, like other places in this country have done, or in this world have done. I mean, Portugal is a great example.
Senator, I'm going to come back to you in 1 minute and ask you how you think it would go over in the legislature when we want to talk about dropping the penalties for a bunch of crimes. Meanwhile, we have Don on the line, who has a point about the drug war being responsible for the situation we are in. Don, tell me, how do you think we got here?
Well, I want to highly recommend a book called Chasing the Scream, S-C-R-E-A-M, by Johann, J-O-H-A-N-N, Hari, H-A-R-I. This is a 2015 book, came out this year. It's available in our Albuquerque Public Library system.
And what's so great about this book?
It focuses on the horrors of the drug war. Many personal stories in all dimensions of the drug war, and going back to the very beginning of it, I know of no other book like it. It's highly recommended by Noam Chomsky, by Naomi Klein, Glenn Greenwald, the former chief of the Seattle Police Department, Norman Stamper, the former deputy chief of LAPD. It is a powerful book.
Thank you for the recommendation, Don.
And also pointing out that there are places like Switzerland, Portugal, Uruguay that have either decriminalized or legalized drugs and deal with it as a health issue that have made marvelous changes.
Thank you for that, Don. And, you know, Senator Ryan, I want to come back to you because the list of folks that Don mentioned who had endorsed this book are really far over on the left, right? Left, correct, of the spectrum. But, you know, I recently interviewed a couple of folks who are writing from the libertarian wing of the Republican Party who are right there next to those folks saying, the government needs to get out of the drug business. This is an invasion in our personal liberty. You know, this is none of their business. They need to get out of it. And the drug war has resulted in a tremendous invasion of our privacy and a disproportionate relationship of power between the police and law enforcement and people, which Emily mentioned brings us to a really intriguing place in politics right now. So, you know, Emily's group, I know she's up at the legislature talking to you guys about these things, and she'll probably be up there again in January. If folks brought to you in the Senate Judiciary Committee or in Courts, Corrections, and Justice, one of the other committees, a plan that would get rid of some of the nonviolent crimes that we have and reduce penalties that we have, what do you think would be some of the concerns across the spectrum that you might hear from your colleagues?
Well, I think there's always a level of detail that will determine, you know, the fate and kind of drives the debate. So that being said, I think there are ways that we can put more discretion into the system. There's ways to reduce the mandatory minimums or eliminate or address mandatory kinds of sentencing for certain things. How far you go is always a question. If you try to go too far, it seems to die before you can have a meaningful discussion. But I think there's receptivity on both sides of the aisle that want to address the overcrowding prisons, the cost of incarceration, and frankly, the locking people up, that that there may be another way instead of locking people up to address issues of addiction and address some of the other issues of exposure to things that their backgrounds and their, you know, how they're growing up may lead them down a path of trouble. And should we be putting everybody in the same category? And I think that's where people's receptivity heightens to a great extent.
Nobody wants to look like they're being soft on crime. Let me ask Republicans out there who are listening, folks who are really concerned about crime, folks who are not comfortable with diverting these folks into treatment programs, why don't you give us a call? We're going to take a quick break right now. So let's get you on the line, 277-5866 here in Albuquerque, or toll free 899-5866. Email callinshow at KUNM.org, post to our Facebook page, KUNM Radio, or tweet at KUNM News, and we'll be right back.
Skip the hassle of finding a buyer for that old vehicle, especially if it's going to cost a lot to get it ready to sell. If you have anything with an engine, we'll spare you the hassle and expense. Plus, you'll get a tax deduction, a KUNM membership, and you'll feel so good knowing that your donation is helping to keep this program on the air. It's so easy. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, sibling rivalry. It seems so common but can cause immediate and long-lasting hurt. Our panel offers ideas on reducing sibling rivalry.
Understand that you're not the same people. You have different ways of thinking about things, but neither of you are more right or more wrong than the other. And when you sit down and you talk about it, you'll understand that what it is that you're fighting about right now is really kind of silly.
That's next time on Peace Talks Radio, Friday morning at 8 on KUNM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. We are talking about the problem that we're having in prisons and local jails right now with overcrowding and folks being in there for a really long time, sometimes sentences that don't feel like they match the crime. And there is a bipartisan push in Congress and a discussion now about reducing mandatory minimum sentences and finding other ways to get people out of prison who maybe could do better elsewhere. We have on the phone Denicia Cadena. Denicia, talk to us about getting criminals out of prison.
Yes. I work in an organization, Young Women United, and we believe that it's really important to center the expertise of people who've been in the criminal justice system. And, you know, I'm just so excited about the bipartisan leadership that's happened in New Mexico to really make this a public safety issue. We've heard today about reducing prison costs and saving money for our state, but the fact is when people have jobs, when people are able to get on the path they really want to be, is that it improves public safety for all of us. What I haven't heard yet this morning is the particular concerns for women. Women are the fastest growing prison population in New Mexico. The women's prison is at capacity, and we really need gender-specific reform because women are the core of our families here in New Mexico.
How do you think we should treat women differently from men in terms of getting them out of this cycle?
You know, we really need trauma-informed treatment centers. A vast majority of women who are in incarceration have lived through physical violence, have lived through sexual trauma. And so if we just address addiction as purely a drug, we're not looking at all the things that have contributed to where people are today and that real trauma.
Oh, right. So you're saying we need to look at the reasons why people have fallen into drug addiction as well as that addiction as causes of the other crimes that get them into the system?
Absolutely, that there's root causes to lead people where they are today, that people don't wake up and decide they want to be in a cycle of addiction and incarceration. And when we're looking at women, we too often separate the adult system and the child welfare system. And that most women desperately want to be reconnected with their families. And so if we can make improvements in the adult system, we can absolutely see improvements in the child welfare system as well.
You know, we mentioned earlier that 3/4 of federal drug offenders who are given mandatory minimum sentences are Black or Hispanic. Denicia, is that the kind of thing that you think we are experiencing here, or is the situation, as it often is, slightly different in New Mexico?
You know, drug crimes across the country are racialized. In New Mexico, I would also include Native American people. We say higher arrest rates for Native American, Hispanic, and Black people. We see longer sentencing times. We actually, in the future, are collaborating on a report on this very issue. But across the country, drug crimes and all crimes are racialized and gendered.
Thank you for that. Thank you for your call today. Emily, I want to go to you. Are there elements of what Denicia said that you are working on? Do you have policy proposals to address any of these things?
Yeah, absolutely. And we work really closely with Denicia and Young Women United and are so impressed by the work they do and the voices and stories they bring to this issue and their work. One of the policy issues that they have worked really hard on, and a Drug Policy Alliance has supported it, or Ban the Box, which we in New Mexico a couple of years ago passed a great law that for state applications, they can't ask if someone on that job application whether they had a past criminal history. And that really equalizes individuals' chance to get to reintegrate back into the workforce and support their families. And Young Women United and Crossroads and Drug Policy Alliance worked together last legislative session to try to expand that policy to all employers in the state to give everyone a fair chance at getting a job. And I anticipate we'll be working again. That didn't pass this last legislative session, but working on that again. But Denicia brings up really good points. I mean, that drug policies are totally racialized, and the gender inequalities that we see. We're seeing that happen also in the LEAD program. We were surprised that the majority of the participants are actually women, young women, and most of them have children. And so, as Captain Sanchez was talking about, this is an opportunity to reframe what we mean by treatment. Treatment means bringing families back together. It means supporting these women and supporting their children. It might mean putting food on their table, buying school supplies, buying clothes. And so I think we need to really think about, from a policy perspective, how we're redefining treatment and where our resources are going. We definitely need more access to inpatient treatment services in our state, but we also need access to all of those other wraparound services that really are part of our treatment modality.
Thank you so much for that, Emily. I want to take a call right now from Larissa in Santa Fe. Larissa, what do you think about what we've just been talking about in terms of providing treatment and other services to drug addicts and folks whose crimes are mostly caused by drugs? Does that sound good to you?
Yes, it does. And I noticed that Spence Pacheco was featured on the news last week for being one of the few cities in the country that does so.
So,
Santa Fe.
And what else do you think about it?
I think it's an extremely effective move. However, I'd be curious as to what the public defenders think about it. They seem to have a lot of leverage in the legislature on interfering with bills that are legal and criminal. So I would be curious what they would think, too.
Do you mean public defenders or prosecutors?
Who lobbies for what?
Oh, okay. Thank you so much for that. We also have Ben in Santa Fe. Ben, what's your question today? Ben, do you have a question or a comment?
Oh, yeah. Hi. This is my name is Ben Bauer. I'm the district public defender up in Santa Fe and Rio Arriba counties.
Ben, our previous caller just asked us what the public defenders think of this, so how convenient that you are here. What do you think of this?
Well, first of all, the people that you've been talking to are doing a wonderful job in pursuing, you know, realistic and thoughtful criminal justice reform. The work of the Drug Policy Alliance to kind of coordinate some of these visions has been extremely important. And I think there's a lot of progress that's being made. One of the things I wanted to bring up is that even though there is a national trend, which is really inspiring. There are always places where we need to make sure that we don't fall back. And recently there have been a few tragic events in New Mexico that have caused the governor, the attorney general, and some other people to call for what I think are steps backwards, expanding the three strikes law, which leads to life without parole, meaning up to the age of 70 and 80 in geriatric prisoners, making per se levels for driving while under the influence of drugs at levels where people are not actually impaired, which is, again, criminalizing the use of drugs. And so while we push forward, we also have to guard against falling backwards.
So, Ben, you mentioned that some folks are calling for the expansion of three strikes laws. What are some of the crimes that would initialize the three strikes? What qualifies for that?
Well, there at this point, there are several. Those include murder. Those include, I believe, kidnapping and some kinds of child abuse charges. It would be expanded to include aggravated batteries, things where people are not hurt to the point where it permanently affects them. And the thing to keep in mind is that the lifespan, the criminal lifespan of many of our clients is actually relatively short. And at some point, people often age out of criminal activity. And if you have life sentences, especially without parole, what you have is unnecessary incarceration of older men and women where they could be productive members of society.
I think, Senator Ryan, let me put this to you. I know that it sounds to a lot of people that to pull back on these three strikes, to reduce sentences, is going to take a really big leap of faith. To say these are people who have committed crimes, some of them nonviolent, stealing a stereo, and some of them quite violent. How do you feel about taking that leap of faith?
Well, that's a really good question for a sponsor of the Three Strikes expansion back a few years ago, and I think there's a difference, and I tend to differ with Ben because. There are violent crimes and people committing violent offenses over and over and over again. And all the programs and all the diversions and all the things that we try to get to these individuals to turn their lives around, there's some in our society that won't turn around and won't make use of these programs and have a career criminal path. And I think those are the people that we want in the prison. And I personally decipher the difference between the very violent crimes that people are getting out on the streets over and over again. And I separate that from the nonviolent mandatory minimums of the various drug issues that I think can be dealt with in some respects, and diversions and programs and that sort of stuff. So I'm... And I think my colleagues, would look at that differently.
Thank you, Ben, for calling in and giving us that perspective. I want to take another call now from Jennifer. Jennifer, welcome to the show. What is your perspective on the cycle of drug abuse and incarceration?
Hi, Gwyneth. In my opinion, I think that we spend too much. We spend too much money and too much of our resources treating addiction in jails and prisons. I think, like Emily mentioned and some of the other folks have mentioned, we don't have enough resources for treatment, and I think that's a big issue. I know when my son was going through his addiction, I was told several times that he would have a better opportunity getting treatment in jail than anywhere else, and that was the case. When he got arrested, actually, there was a really good treatment program at the county jail here in Bernalillo County. So, it's frustrating because you know that when they're young, they need help and they need assistance, but when you go and try and find that help and assistance, a lot of times it's not there. And for someone struggling with substance abuse, they're going to turn to crime. I mean, there's just no way around it. They're going to have to find ways to support their drug habit. And eventually their money runs out, their resources run out, and they turn to stealing and they turn to theft and other violent crimes. And, there's just no way around it.
Jennifer, in your experience, why do you think it is that it's so hard to find drug treatment programs outside of jail and prison?
I think part of it is that we as a society tend to treat addiction as a moral failure and not a disease. So our, you know, funding is very tight for substance abuse treatment. What Medicaid covers is very limited. A lot of insurance companies only cover short-term treatment options. They don't cover longer-term treatment. So they expect you to just go into a, you know, a 28-day program and be, you know, cured, miraculously fixed when you get out. And the fact of the matter is it's a chronic relapsing disease that needs long-term treatment, and it's really hard to find funding, and it's really hard to find insurance and Medicaid coverage that will cover someone needing a longer-term treatment.
Jennifer, thank you so much for that. We have one last call here from Stephen in Albuquerque. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be talking. I've been involved in several different levels, many different levels of the criminal justice and treatment areas in mental health and addictions. And one thing, being a recent transplant from Oregon, I'm not sure if New Mexico has drug courts. That's a good thing to start with. It sounds like the lead
Stephen,
program has.
You know, we only have a few minutes left in the show. If you have one point that you want to share with us, what would that one point be?
Well, that one point is 2 points quickly, but they're all the same. Alcohol is a drug, and people need treatment, and a therapeutic community inside a prison is a good way to address that. And diversions are effective, and I do interventions, so I know that people need to have some kind of program to go into before they get in and when they get into the program.
Thank you.
Into the treatment, into the incarceration.
Thank you so much for that. Emily, I want to go back to you and ask you what you think the impact will be if we see action in Congress. No matter what Congress does, the fact is the majority of this work is done here in the states. A lot of these decisions are going to come down to the states, and a lot of the money comes here. So what do you think will happen if Congress actually does, as I suppose is possible, take action on this before August?
Well, I think it'll send a message to the rest of the states that if we reform sentencing at a federal level, that it's time to do that at a state level. So I hope we see a ripple effect down to the states. And I mean, it also shows that our politicians are now really more closely aligned with our public opinion. Our public's opinion has been right on this issue for many years. You know, we did a poll many years ago in New Mexico, and 80% of New Mexican voters that were asked the question supported treatment over incarceration. Now we just have to define what that means. So we need to bring it back to our state legislature. We have to look at putting all options on the table, and that might be reducing penalties, that might be eliminating crime, and reducing that pipeline into our jails and prisons.
Thank you, Emily Kaltenbach of the Drug Policy Alliance, and our other guests on the KUNM call-in show. Earlier, we had Santa Fe Police Department Captain Jerome Sanchez, and in the studio with us here, we have State Senator John Ryan. Thank you, Senator.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Good morning. And thank you, Emily. We have posted links to the information we discussed today on our website. You can check them out at kunm.org. If you missed any of our program or you'd like to share it with friends, the audio of this show will be posted on our website, where you can also find audio from previous KUNM call-in shows. You can email comments about this show to callinshow@kunm.org. Find us on Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or follow The Newsroom on Twitter at KUNM News. Thanks also to Jefferson White, our engineer today. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls, and Marisa DeMarco is our executive producer. I'm your host, Gwyneth Doland.